It's Sunday morning. Time for the great outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show here on WGN Radio. We approach the celebration of St. Patrick's Day in Chicago. The river will be dyed green. Actually, the river has already dyed green. Of course, it, for most of my life in Chicago and most of yours, it was probably green to begin with. But now it's clinged up a whole lot. So to make it be green, we dye it. Birds. I promised you at the end of last week's show that I would talk about what's going on with birds. It's springtime. And after all, spring is when we look forward to seeing the robins, whether it's out on a lawn, whether it's on a little patch of grass along a sidewalk, whether it's out in a cornfield. We see the arrival of the birds that have made spring sing. And spring is supposed to be filled with songs of birds. Unfortunately, it's less and less so. And there's been a new study published in the Journal of Science that really says that we are facing a difficult time, as we knew we are, have been hearing we are, to do with birds. And so Cornell Lab several years ago published a study, which has now been well quoted, that there's somewhere between 2 and 3 billion fewer birds in North America than there were 50 years ago. What we're now finding out, as I mentioned last week very briefly at the end, is that not only are the birds declining, but in certain areas of the country, they're declining much faster. And from 87 to 2021, a major study was done on regions of the country where birds are declining. And it turns out that the largest declines are in areas of the most intensive agriculture areas. This also has been now collaborated with a study that's been done in Europe, where bird decline is also self-evident. And we're really talking about songbirds and insect-feeding birds here. We're not talking about larger birds. It appears swans and geese and cranes and all kinds of raptors are doing incredibly well. It's the birds at the lower end of the food chain that are having such trouble. Robins, cardinals, finches, warblers, the birds that come to your bird feeder and that we so love to see. In areas of the country where birds are declining fastest, it definitely ties to widespread agricultural areas. And there's never one reason that populations decline or increase. But in this case, it seems as though the primary reason that birds are declining, small birds, is they're dependent on insects. Small birds eat a great number of insects for survival. All birds eat insects, but particularly small birds. And in agricultural areas where insecticides are heavily used for commercial agriculture, there are a lot fewer bugs. So between the study in Europe and the study taking place here in the United States, there seems to be a very strong correlation between the amount of the decline in birds and the intensity of agriculture, which makes sense. There are fewer insects in agricultural areas than there used to be. Milkweed has been virtually eliminated. Roundup Ready crops, all the things that we do so that we can feed the world and provide affordable food for Americans are also things that work at a cross purpose for many birds. So it is not likely the decline is going to be stemmed. Nobody really knows how we would begin to do that, except there are lots of efforts to have riparian areas, buffers, areas of milkweed, areas of pollinators. We talk about the loss of butterflies. We are losing rapidly the number of acres to pollinators in America. Lots of prairies being planted or restored, but it's a fraction of 1%. Illinois has lost over 99% of its native prairie, as have all the prairie states. They've all lost over 99% of their native prairie. So it's pretty hard to think that we can provide enough habitat for birds that are in decline just by providing more pollinators, more milkweed, etc. So it comes back to agriculture and insecticides. And it also comes back to those of us who have lawns and golf courses and fertilizers and chemicals. All that comes together to conspire against making it hard for birds to survive, particularly small birds. So Rachel Carson wrote a long time ago a book called Silent Spring. It was about DDT and what DDT was doing to the environment. Fortunately, many of the things that she predicted would happen did not happen, but they didn't happen because we took action. If we had not taken the action that was risen, we were made aware of at the time, it's quite possible much of what Carson wrote in Silent Spring would have, Rachel Carson wrote, would have come true. It was a wake-up call to America. So here we are in 2026, and maybe there's another wake-up call to America. Our small bird populations are really in steep decline. Birds in general are in steep decline, and there are reasons for it. But overall, it appears that the number one reason is that we are losing our insect populations, and we can tie all that directly back to how we're using the land. On the other side of the equation, talking about birds that aren't supposed to be here. Let's talk about that for a second. So we talk about birds in general. How about the house sparrow? It was introduced in 1852. It's often called a finch, but we call it a house sparrow, but it's really a finch. And it was introduced to New York in 1852, and now it's all across the country. How about the starling? It was introduced also in New York. Had a lot to blame New York for. Three of the most invasive bird species in the United States all were introduced in New York. In the 1890s, starlings were brought over in New York from Europe, and lo and behold, they've spread across the continent. Mute swans, they came in the late 1800s, and they also came to New York, and they were brought over to be decorative for ponds. Well, they've traveled the country now, and they're so populous in California that they actually have an open season on mute swans to try to get rid of their population. Rock pigeons, they came a long time ago. Rock pigeons came in the late 1600s, and as we know, they were used as messenger pigeons during times of war. They have populated the entire country, but they're the earliest invasive species that we're aware of in the 1600s. And then as recently as the 18, and these are the top invasive species now in America. So you got the house sparrow, otherwise known as a finch. You've got starlings. You've got mute swans. You've got rock pigeons. And now comes the Eurasian collared dove. It was first found in Florida only 40 years ago in the 1980s. And today it is found almost in every state across the United States, lower 48. There is, again, no season on them. They are an invasive species. They do very much compete, we think, with mourning doves. They're found more around buildings and farmsteads, but you can find Eurasian collared doves in downtown Chicago. You can find them in Louisiana. Almost any of you listening to the show this morning, you've got a Eurasian collared dove in your neighborhood, and that's over 40 years. They weren't here 40 years ago. And then how about the water cattle egret? That came from Africa in the 1940s, and they came on their own. It's believed that a hurricane brought them, and they now are popular throughout the South and throughout the West. So we've got five major bird species that when we think of birds in general, we're not supposed to be here at all. But they are part of the mix of what makes the songs of nature and the songs of spring and the beauty of birds. And I don't fault any bird that's found its way to America and has thrived here. It adds to the the beauty of our country. And those of you who have listened to me for a long time know I just love birds in all forms. I love watching them. I fortunately spent a lifetime in hunting them with my family and friends and love eating them. But I also find that birds provide, as so many of us do, the symphony of music in the air. And as spring comes, look to the skies. You'll see waves of schemes of birds going north, but also look out there on the lawn, and hopefully you'll hear a robin and see a robin. They are the true harbinger of spring. But robins and cardinals and all the birds that bring music to our ears, we only wish we had more of them. I'll be back in just a moment with much more on the Great Outdoors Show. There's an interesting study out of Michigan. I'm also going to talk a little bit about the Colorado River and the Great Salt Lake. Thanks so much for listening. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN. And first, a message from our longtime sponsors, the Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
Hiking, camping, and hunting, it's all an adventure in the great outdoors, but nature can be tough. You need to be ready for anything and everything. Chevy Silverado is built to handle the toughest conditions and get you everywhere you want to go worry-free. Silverado's designed to handle the big jobs. It's built for the great outdoors. With over 13,000 pounds of towing capacity and trailering sway control, Silverado can haul the biggest loads on the roughest roads and keep you cool as a Sunday drive. With 8 available cameras and up to 14 different views, it can spot trouble before it gets to you. That's peace of mind. And when you're ready for the backcountry, Chevy Silverado 1500 ZR2 owns the off-road. You name it, we run over it. No wonder it's Motor Trend's 2023 four-wheeler pickup truck of the year. So see your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer or go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and check out a Chevy Silverado. It's freedom to explore the great outdoors.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. Thank you so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed the first part of the show on birds. And if you didn't catch the first part of the show, well, you can podcast it, of course. But basically, spring is the sound, is the season of sounds, the sounds of birds returning. So what is going on with the Colorado River? It's a big subject, and what I'm just going to touch on right now, but the bottom line is there is far more water appropriated to be used from the Colorado River than exists in the Colorado River. And at the time of the Powell expedition, when they did all the surveys of the Colorado River, we were in a very wet cycle in the American West, arguably the wettest cycle, some think, in over 1,000 years. So they thought there were some 19 million acre feet. That would be 19 million acres covered 1 foot deep of water that exists in the Colorado River. Well, there's not 19 million acre feet. It's probably more like 12 million and maybe even 14 or 10. It varies, but it's nowhere near 19. But the Western states all appropriated water based upon the belief there was 19 million acres of water, acre feet of water to share. And they were only off by 30 or 40%. So the treaties that have been in existence and the rights that have been in existence for a long time are all up for renewal. It's a very contentious subject because, after all, the West has grown enormously. Phoenix, Los Angeles, Salt Lake, the whole West has tens of millions of people it did not have in it when the first water rights were appropriated for agriculture use. So there is going to be sacrifice. There's going to be hand-wringing. There's going to be political clout. It's a fascinating story that is unfolding literally as I speak. And over the coming months, there has to be a settlement on the reappropriation of the water rights. And if you ever want to dig more deeply into this, there's an absolutely wonderful book written by Mark Reisner called Cadillac Desert, which is, well, it's the history of water in the West. It's a fantastic read about California and water. It's not just about water. It's about, frankly, the birth of California and how it survived. And there's a great intrigue in the corruption of Los Angeles and how the Los Angeles city fathers duped other people into getting water to come to L.A. So the story of water rights in the West, and particularly the Colorado River, it affects all of us. We don't think it does here in Chicago, but actually it does, because it has a lot to do with agricultural crops, has a lot to do with human settlement. But one thing we absolutely know for sure is there is not enough water in the West to provide for the people living there and for the agricultural production that is required or being used today. So stay tuned. I'll have more on that in the coming weeks, and also tie it in with the Great Salt Lake, which you're going to hear much more about. It's not only as an IMAX film, which I had something to do with being released on the Great Salt Lake, but the Great Salt Lake this summer, if something doesn't change, it's going to reach new record lows, and that'll draw even more international recognition to its potential demise and what happens if it indeed, tragically, it's impossible to believe that a lake that's 1,850 square miles in size could disappear. We can't let it happen. There'll be more on that in the coming months, but certainly this is going to be a tough year in the West. But moving from the West to a state that has plenty of water, how about the state of Michigan? We love our neighbors in Michigan. Many of you listening this morning live in Michigan, and there's a very interesting report out from the state of Michigan on the acceptance of hunters, and it comes from the Michigan Wildlife Council. And by the way, Michigan did a really smart thing. $1 of every license sale, whether it's hunting license or fishing sale license, has to be used for communications about the virtues of hunting and fishing and why they are an important part of wildlife management. Think what would happen if all the states did that. We would have a much better informed public. All of us would be better informed, not as a proponents of hunting, but why hunting and fishing is so important in wildlife management. Well, what the study shows, after just being added a short period of time, is that as a result of the work in Michigan, more people now favorably view hunting and fishing as pursuits that should be pursued for wildlife management than did before the work began. It's not surprising. but it does go to show that if you communicate the virtues of wildlife management and the ethics and the traditions of hunting and fishing for wildlife management, Americans will respond and better understand the situation. There's certainly going to be lots of people who always say, I think it's absolutely abhorrent you fish or catch anything. But more and more individuals, at least in Michigan, are coming to realize that wildlife management is essential to the management of our wildlife populations and our fishery populations, and that management includes hunting and fishing as the core essential element. So good news out of Michigan that they are doing this, and also that they have provided a funding source on an ongoing basis to provide information to the general public about why hunting and fishing is important. Moving from Michigan and the study they're doing and information on public outreach for the benefits of hunting and fishing to wildlife management, I'm going to shift quickly to the drought map. It's that time of the year when we cast our eyes north towards the prairies of the United States and Canada, the cradle of bird life populations when it comes to the breeding grounds. And the news is better than last year and better than the year before. It's not great, but it is the first hint of being better. For the first time in 2 years, the Dakotas, North and South Dakota, which are the most important breeding grounds in America, the lower 48 for birds, for the first time, the entire state of both North and South Dakota are out of the drought monitor index. Also, northeastern Montana is in much better shape. Those three areas can produce up to 40 to 50% of North America's waterfowl, prairie nesting waterfowl. Then also prairie Canada, Manitoba, southwestern Manitoba is much better than it's been. And moving up through southeastern and central Saskatchewan, also they're much better than they've been. So we're looking at a situation where for the first time really in 3 years, critical areas of the prairie are in better conditions than they have been as birds begin to return north. There still are areas, particularly as you go west in the prairies, there are still areas that are really, really dry. But we still have a month or so to go. Here we are in the middle of March. We really have until about the 1st of May to replenish so many of those wetlands. And after that, then it really the first nesting birds will have already done their thing or bypassed the region. But I'm happy to say, and I had nothing to do with it, obviously, but I'm happy to say that the breeding grounds for the first time in a while, 3 years, in fact, are looking much better. So I thank you very much for listening this morning. I will be back next Sunday morning with much more in the great outdoors. Have a great St. Patrick's Day, everyone, and a safe week in the great outdoors as winter comes to an end and spring is upon us. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.